Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible live from Gainesville, Florida and Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man. Good to hear from you today. We're going to talk a few texts and think about preaching for the seventh Sunday after Pentecost. These are the texts for July the 19th, 2020. That's about all I need to say about that. You know, some days I worry about having an intro. I think most of y'all listening understand what we do here. We pull up the text. We like to jaw on them for a few minutes. Think about, well, now, how do you do that in a sermon? And how does it connect? And when we're done talking, we'll cut the show off. And that'll be it. So
the reason they call this ordinary time, we're just doing ordinary shows during ordinary time.
We're just a couple of ordinary Bubbas. What do you got on your mind this week? Let's think about.
On the one hand, you know, I like to start out with the theme that runs throughout, and this is a time, particularly since we're using the semi-continuous Old Testament lesson, Hebrew Scripture lesson. And the psalm that goes with it. This is a time when there is no chosen theme that runs through all. I mean, we're walking through Matthew right now, Matthew 13 for 3 weeks in a row, and we're just walking through Matthew. We're walking through Romans. We're walking through the Genesis stories of the patriarchs. And so there's no thematic connection intended between the text except the connection of the psalm to the Genesis text. But never fear. Dr. Bubba number two, that would be me, is going to find a theme if he can.
And there's a theme to be had in these babies. Delmer's going to find it.
I had done all the work yesterday afternoon, and I'll tell you, it's one of those moments. I was laying in the bed, and I kind of woke up, and I said, I need to turn on the light and write that down. It was running in my head.
That's the way it works.
There is a theme that I'm calling a not this, but that dynamic in each set of lessons. Hmm. A not this, but that. Now, let me tell you what I mean. In Jacob, in Genesis, there is a grace verse if you think about who Jacob was. Jacob's a scoundrel, yet he is the receiver and the bearer of the promise. He's not the kind of person that most of us would think would be earning this kind of thing. We can, you know, quickly examine his life and this period and realize what a scoundrel he is. I don't have to go through all of that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet he's the one who receives a promise. So not this, but that, not merit, but grace. You get into Romans, it's a major contrast story. Life in the flesh versus life in the spirit.
Right.
Not this, but that. And then you get into Matthew, you've got good seed and bad weeds. Who are the faithful and who are the faithless, and how do you deal with them? So there is a theme today. I don't think I shoehorned it in there. I think there's a not this, but that to these and how we might preach today to realize that there is what looks obvious as the way we live it, and the gospel comes in all of these lessons and says, no, this is how God is.
I think that's great, and if nothing else, it is a helpful way to begin organizing these texts, but I think it's a good approach. I would just be careful if you're going to go with that good seed, bad weed.
Well, I'll come to that in a minute.
Be sure you get the S on there, because good seed, bad weed, kind of, you know, if it drops off, people are going, wait, what? What'd he be, what's he talking
Marijuana?
About?
So let's go to Genesis, and I'm gonna have one of my contrary moments. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure we can sing that song all day long if we want to, but just know we're not climbing Jacob's ladder, at least not according to the text. We do not climb Jacob's ladder. Notice it's angels and descending the stairway to heaven, which is actually a better translation than there ladder.
Better song, so, too.
Better song, too. So, depends on, you know, your vintage, I guess.
Yeah.
But one of that's an important thing, because it's either, again, that's that merit versus grace. We are climbing Jacob's ladder, and you read the text. No, we're not.
Nope.
We're laying there on the ground, undeserving, fugitive from brother's justice, just scared to death and just drop dead tired, and grace comes. He didn't know this was a holy place. This is one of my points. It didn't become a holy place. He didn't run to a holy place. He stopped when it got dark. It's like riding down the interstate and you're getting tired, and what's the nearest hotel I could stay in without being afraid of getting some?
That's it.
You know, he just stopped because he was tired. And in that place, like, good things happen. This is not about achievement, but about growth. And on this Sunday, it might be a good Sunday, preaching-wise, to sort of retell a little bit about who Jacob is up to this point and who he is after this. You know, that even after this, his character didn't change. It wasn't an immediate conversion to niceness. You know, he has a long story of being who he is, you know, but yet he's a scoundrel, and yet God blesses. He comes to this place. He's tired. He's running because after he cheated his brother out of his birthright with the food, you know, that we had that story. Then we have this whole thing where his daddy is dying, and he deceives him, takes advantage of him, makes him think he's his brother so he will bless him, you know, and does all of this with his mother's connivance. And, you know, this is through. This is like getting your daddy to change the will when he's incompetent.
And yeah, that's the, you know, equivalent.
And then Esau finds out, and Balma says, "Huh, I guess you better run." Remember, Esau's the hunter.
Sons die on the same day. You need to get out of here, boy.
You need to get out of here. So he's leaving with nothing at this point. He's a fugitive. He's going back to where Abraham was from, trying to hook up with some family. He's headed back to the old country, the only place he feels like he could be safe. And he's tired, and he lays down. And you can imagine how he's feeling. I've lost everything. I have just messed up. And he's not feeling exactly remorse. There's no remorse there. He's just trying to survive. And in the night, he has a vision. And he says, "Oh, surely this is a holy place." I don't know it's a holy place, but it's a holy, wherever divine human encounters happen, that's a house of God. And you can't, it's not limited. So, you know, it's not limited to go into something we designate as a house of God.
Right.
Holy places and holy things happen where God chooses. Jacob was not looking for a nap. But God controls God's promise. I think that's the message underneath here. And I think if I were preaching this, part of it is there are two audiences always. There's the ones who feel like they deserve God's grace. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who need to hear, you have received God's grace, but not because you deserved it.
You can do anything to get it. Yeah.
And the other ones is the people who feel like they don't deserve anything, and they have messed up, and they have just don't deserve anything. They're just tired, and they're struggling, and they can look at their lives and feel how they felt, and they need to hear that. Just like with Jacob, God's grace comes to us because of God's willingness, not because of our deserving.
Absolutely. And I would just tie a little bit onto there, as I've been working the series from Genesis this summer. The guiding question is always, what do we learn of God, the character of God, and God's relationship with God's people? And so I love it. Just what you've pointed out. This is not a particularly holy place. Jacob is not, quote, seeking God or searching for God. He's on the run. He's just, you know, he's just being Jacob. And yet when God reaches out, his response is in verse 17, and the NRSV captures this. Awesome, man. Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm working with in my current congregation. We have a lot of retirees and quite a few of them from the Northeast, from Maine and Massachusetts and other places. This would be wicked awesome. Okay. Wicked awesome. This is really something. God has been here. And it is a revelation to this young man. He may or may not. Now, he knew from his daddy and his daddy and them about God, but I don't think we see Jacob as particularly a religious boy. But he sees something here. This is the God who is. We're going to get to Moses, of course, at the end of this cycle, and I am. Tell them I am has sent you. But this is a glimpse at the God who is, the God who is everywhere. The God is the God who is at work, or at the very minimum, present in places not only we would never expect, but in places that we don't know about. And so his eyes are opened through this dream, and here's the presence of God and the message of God. And for Jacob, it is, I don't know if we call it yet life altering, but it is a significant marker, which is what the end of the story is. So he takes the stone and he sets it up, and he anoints it with oil and calls it the house of God. So what is God's relationship to God's people? Reaching out, speaking, working in unexpected ways, and opening the path, opening the door. Jacob's not who he's yet intended to be. But as you've said, worthy or not, here's the grace of God. And for the purposes of the longer narrative, this is the assurance that the covenant will continue.
It will continue.
Yeah. And that's
And one of the things when you're talking about, it's not a life altering, but it is.
Well, it is.
As he looks back. And I think that's true for most of us. Most of us, and I've said this many times, most of us do not have a Damascus road to look back on.
Mm-hmm.
Some do. But we have little moments along the way that we become aware of God's presence, and then we live our ordinary life, but those begin to build and we begin to change. Yeah. And I think that's what happens with Jacob. This is one of those moments along the way that he remembers and forgets in equal measure. He remembers and forgets week after life in his life, and eventually life changes and you wake up and you're different and you don't know when it happened. And I think that's the life of grace, the life of growth.
It is. And remember another thing we're keeping in mind for those of you that may be building this into a series, is that every incident in this in the lectionary, each passage stands on its own and has plenty for us to learn and plenty for us to think about, but they're also fitting together and there's a narrative being built here. And so this is something of a bookend or the front end, if you will, of Jacob's encounters with God. And so here's the opener. This, you know, gets his attention. Yeah, it's a spot he remembers. We're going to continue with Jacob. He's going to have a few more encounters. And then on the way back, he's going to have another significant encounter with God.
The other one, remember the wrestling.
That's it. So we're coming back. So when in terms of the narrative, they do fit together. And it's kind of a couple of encounters with God that we hang Jacob's narrative on. I'm rushing because we're going to get to Joseph too, but it's just good work. And this is good literary work. And so we don't want to give any too much away, but we do want to be kind of like Jacob. We want to set up a stone here for our purposes. And we're going to remember this when we come back in a few weeks and we have his story of what's happened to him and how he's changed. And when he's headed in the other direction, his encounter with God.
So tying the Psalm 139 was picked to go with this, and it's an interesting psalm. This psalm is known to be what's called a prayer for justice for someone who's in some kind of legal suit of some nature. It may be at the temple itself, a religious kind of trial. It may be separate from that, although hard to separate those two in the culture in which the Psalms were brought. And so a vast majority of it is a plea by the person who feels like he's being unjustly treated to say, look at me, know me, et cetera. And then at the end, a kind of confidence in God's judgment. The section that we have here, I think the way it's tied to Genesis has to do with particular verses, because Jacob's not coming before God and pleading for justice. He's not paying any attention. But you look at verse 3, and it does it kind of sideways. You know, you've got the lying down and 7 and 8. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? You know, God's going to be there kind of thing. If you ascend to heaven, you're there. My bed in Sheol, that's the ascending and descending image. And you get over to verse 11. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light around me become night. This happened at night, that even there God can be there. I think that's the way in which that's connected. There's those images that reflect the experience that Jacob had in Genesis. And my favorite line in this is 23, verse 20, God, and know my heart. Mm-hmm. Test me and know my thoughts. And I want to ask you, how many of us are brave enough to say that and mean it?
and it is, it makes a wonderful prayer. This is these two verses are verses I memorized a long time ago and have used many, many times, personal prayer, corporate prayer, because again, in the tie to Jacob, God already knows our hearts. God already knows our thoughts. This is our willingness. This represents our end of the covenant to open and say, yes, God, search me and know my heart. And really, it may be as much for us as it is for God, but it's our end. I need your searching. I need you to know my heart. Go ahead, know all of my thoughts. I'm holding nothing back. And then that last phrase, lead me in the way everlasting. I know I don't get there all on my own. So I like it for its openness. It is us responding in a way to God.
Right.
God doesn't need us to open our minds so that God can know what's in there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. God already knows. It's our being willing to be open.
Absolutely.
And recognize. So moving to Romans, I want to say that Romans 8, 12 through 25, I'm not going to walk through this entire text. And, it's very complex as usual with Paul's thought. So it says, so then, so it's based off of the last week in the 1 through 11, in which he talks about life in the spirit, like, and so today is, so then, if we're living in the spirit, what does that mean? And this is, as usual, Paul's thought is complex and somewhat repetitive. And I think part of the reason for this is, and this is speculation of historical critical, is that he probably was dictating this with a stenographer or an amanuensis, somebody writing it down. And so, like me talking right now, it kind of goes in circles, start and stop, and the person writing it down may not have known when to leave stuff out. That's part of it. But I think he meant what he said, and it's complex and repetitive. But I think the key thought, the key thought here is where we live affects how we think and act. The question is, where are you living? We Southerners have a tendency to ask people, where are you from? We don't mean by that. Some people take it this way. They hear us say, and you don't belong here, and I'm judging where you're from. That's not what we mean 99 out of 100 times. Right. What we mean is we are traditional culture type people, and we can't know you till we know where you're coming from. That's in the culture. Now, for us, geography has a lot to do with where you're coming from. I think for the larger culture in the country and in the world, where you're coming from is perhaps a position, a socioeconomic position, et cetera, et cetera. But even outside of the South, there's a difference between New York and LA. Where are you from? From the Midwest, you know, when we talk about this. So Paul's moving that from a geography to a notion of where do we live. If we live in the flesh or we live in the spirit, it affects how we think and what we do. And he said, if you're still living in the flesh, and then as you walk through there, you'll find these images that he's contrasting with life in the spirit. You have slavery versus childhood. You have captivity versus adoption. You have bondage versus freedom. You have being alone versus being a part of the whole creation that's being redeemed. You have decay and despair and death over in the flesh. And contrast it with that, you have hope and faith and life. And if you walk through this, you'll see that he's playing these off one another. And his encouragement is, live in the spirit. Now, that's not a pie in the sky by and by. It's not a do away with any sense of your body. It's not about your body. It's about what drives you, and where the flesh for Paul is more an image of being about this, as he says, if we for this world only we have hoped, we are of all people most to be pitied. He said, be aware of those subliminal places where we are connected. This back to Jacob, who has this experience, which is a vision. But if he lived from that day forward only in the flesh, he took a nap, felt better the next day and went on. Then he is still a fugitive and decay and all that. But he had an experience of the spiritual. He lived in that spirit to the extent of building, surely this is a place of God. And he began to grow in an awareness of that. That's the kind of thing Paul's talking about. Don't let just your earthly experience dictate your understanding of reality, Paul says, but know Christ is the Holy Spirit. Move into that realm.
And I want to extend your analogy from a little earlier when we say, where are you from? That is a different question from where do you live?
Exactly.
Where do you stay? Because some people say, I stay.
Yeah. Where do you stay?
Where I live, so-and-so. And actually here, this is, okay, well, I acknowledge, and this ties in with the psalm that we were just talking about, Know My Heart. I acknowledge I'm from Flesh Town.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. I'm from there. I am thoroughly fleshly. I think of and Paul makes this wonderful and intricate argument, as you say. I don't want to do, I do the things I don't want to do, et cetera. We had that a couple of weeks ago. I'm from Flesh Town. But what he's trying to help us to see is, but you can live in Spiritville or Spirit Town. We can live a life guided by the Spirit, empowered by the Spirit, live. We don't have to, just because we're from Flesh Town, continue to live that way. And so it struck me, that's the other part of the analogy you raised. And for me, it resonates. That may not get it for everybody, but he is encouraging us to live differently because of the work of the Spirit in and around us and in the world and delivering creation from its groaning and all the other wonderful images that are in here.
Yeah. Right. You know, I always tell people when they ask me where I'm from, and I said, I am from Mount Airy, North Carolina, and it's a wonderful place to be from. And I am from there, but I have had a lot of time since then, so I'm not still there. There's a lot of positive things about being from where I'm from, but I don't live there. And that's what you're saying. It shapes, but it's not where you stay.
That's it.
Right, moving to Matthew and good seed and bad weeds. You know, I got a few things I want to say on this. This is another divided pericope, in which you have the parable, you have a little gap, and then you have the interpretation. The parable is told to the crowd, and then it says, then they gets the disciples alone, and he interprets to them, which makes me, it makes it kind of interesting. I think this is a Matthean, author of Matthew kind of technique, because we say Jesus told parables to be clear in his teaching, but over and over again, the disciples don't get it, and then Jesus has to interpret it for them. I have no doubt these are stories that Jesus told, and I think the interpretation is one that the author of Matthew is making to the church at the time in which he's writing to remind them of some things using Jesus' original parable. But I think he's relatively accurate. But we do need to understand that the interpretation is an application to the early church community and some of the things that they're dealing with, in which the author says to the disciples, as the Greek chorus, you know, the group, the everybody who's getting interpreted to, and he tells them things. So you've got this story of the owner doesn't go out and sow. He has servants go out and sow. So this is an interesting story. The owner goes out, and then his enemy. So you got this person and that person. And he sows the seed, and they grow. And then the enemy sows weeds, and the weeds come up. And then the workers finally get into the act. And they say, you want us to go pull up the weeds? And he says, no, you'll destroy the weed itself. So just wait till we harvest. It'll be easier to separate them then. And then we'll separate the good and we'll separate the bad and burn it, which unfortunately some people interpret as I'll throw them suckers into hell.
Final judgment.
It is a judgment thing. So here I think then you get the story later and the interpretation. Here's some things I think we really need to think about this as we think of Matthew to the church, which means to us. Don't try to figure out who's good and who's bad. You can't do it. One of the interesting things about reading from a variety of text is sometimes you run across things you wouldn't find in anywhere in a Hebrew commentary or this sort of thing. I was reading the Revised English Version, which was, you remember, the English Bible, you know, it was the English Bible. When we did the RSV and the NRSV, they were doing the English Version, the Revised English Version, the Oxford Annotated Revised English Version, you get there, and the weeds are translated darnel. You ever heard of darnel? I grew up on a farm. I'd never heard of darnel. I look it up. It's a Eurasian ryegrass. They used in the English translation, in the English book, mm-hmm. and it's apparently known there. And it's known as false wheat. Mm-hmm. And they showed the picture, and it looks almost exactly wheat until it gets at a certain level, almost to harvest. Then you can tell the difference. One of them's wheat with grain you can make into bread, and the other is a weed, but you can't tell the difference till they mature. I think they're on to something. Their assumption is this is what weeds talk about. Because, you know, most of the time you can walk out in the field and here's this beautiful plant and here's this ugly weed. And what he's saying is they look almost exactly alike.
Pretty hard to tell while it's all still growing in there. So be careful.
So you can't tell because your efforts are premature. You're gonna whack out more than this is the second thing. You're gonna harm as many of the faithful as you do of the faithless, because you can't tell the difference. Which moves on to judging is God's business and not ours. And how often has the church beat itself up and injured itself over and over about prematurely trying to decide who's right and who's wrong by some peculiar and odd standard? That looking back, reading church history, we just shake our heads and look back and say, well, how could they get that upset about that?
And then we turn around and do the same things.
Do the same kind of stuff over and over and over again. And so this warning against non-judgment going all the way back to the time that the Gospels were written in the early days of the church reminds us it's human nature to try to sit around and say who the good guys and who the bad guys are. And if I may take this beyond the church into the world we're living in, we are polarized in this country. We are getting more and more polarized. Fingers are getting pointed. And I'm just going to say on the right, there are people are saying you're not right, far right enough and accusing each other. And unfortunately on the left, the same thing's happening. And suddenly they're after people that we're saying, well, my goodness, if that person's not left enough, nobody is. Mm. And we're doing this and we're judging and we're deciding who's acceptable and who's in. And frankly, we gotta be careful. We have ideas, but we do not need to be talking about people. This is a message of this text. We can talk about ideas, but we don't know. And it's hard to tell. And we've got to leave some judgment to God. And I done quit preaching and going to meddling, so I'll back off for a minute.
And I'm with you because to me, as I try to step back and say, okay, what's the takeaway here? Okay. And, yeah. And sort of the what difference does it make question we often ask. We get confused when we think our job as the church is weed pulling.
Yep.
Okay. We get confused. That is not our job. Read Jesus' explanation of the parable to the disciples. Our job is to simply be the seed that are planted in the world and to grow from there and to do what seed do. Right? Yep. Good seed are the children of the kingdom, not the weed workers, not the, you know. So you've got good seed and bad weeds. I'd have, we ain't a bunch of weed whackers. Maybe that's my thought that's in the cool. sermon.
So here's, yeah, that leads to my second point, which is I don't, it may be shoehorning in the text, but I don't think so. I think another thing to think about here is we're assuming that the division is between these people are good and these people are bad. Alexander Solzhenitsyn in Gulag Archipelago said, it would be easy if we could draw a line between the good folks and the bad folks. He said, but the line between good and evil in this world goes right down the middle of every human heart. And the word of God gets spread. And just like with Jacob, some of it's good and bad, good seed and tares are living in us all the time. And you start trying to rip out the bad, you're ripping out the good as well. Mm-hmm. Our struggle is not external all the times with we're good and those other people are bad. Our struggle is how do we deal with the weeds in our lives without tearing out the good? I think that's another level to go into and say, we've got to let this grow and we've got to begin to sort it out and assume that the good is stronger than the darnel. You got to assume that it's going to grow and we don't need to go around judging. We need to see to ourselves. And work on our lives as we anticipate, as we say, so he shall come again to judge the living and the dead.
That's
the
it.
Living that is within us and that which needs to die.
May the
amen
sun
and amen.
Of the kingdom shine in our lives this week. Good yep. text. You ought to be able to find something to walk around in and find something to say this week. Our thoughts, prayers, and very best wishes are with all of you who teach, preach, and in any manner seek to open the word among God's people this week. Yes, sir, Bubba.
I want props for doing that whole last thing without saying Martin Luther or Satan Center at the same time. I just want to add it. Oh, darn, I did it. Never mind.
There you go. You got her in there. All right, Bubba. Luther Peel and all, there's not much left for us to do today other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Safety Net, performed by Riot. We go out today with Except for Grace, performed by the Martins, written by Jeff Sylvie.
Except for me.